One of the things that's made a remarkable change since the early middle days of the Broadcasters Clinic, I think, is that we've all learned better time management. I'm sure many of you remember the days when the last presentation of the day had about 15 seconds because everything had run over. And if we've learned anything here, it appears to be that. One of the things I'd like to share is something that I mentioned to Chris Alexander, who is in our audience this morning. Chris shares every bit of knowledge he's ever learned, I think, via a website and a series of papers that are on his Crawford Broadcasting Company website. If you haven't seen them, they're remarkable. I was fortunate to work with a man in Minneapolis named Jerry Miller, who loved to, he's like Art Reese. He's always got a cogent comment, and Jerry's comment was learn, earn, and return, which means to be a success in life, you've got to learn something, but in the process, you're probably going to earn some money or you're not going to be very healthy and happy. But the last part of it is return that knowledge to other people. That's the way it's all going to work for all of us. So keep that in mind. Here's a person who does that very well, Jeremy Ruck. I'd like to present you. I'm not sure what this is. It says a Wisconsin passport, and you think that it's an offer to get out of town?
Yeah, I think everybody wants me to get out of here and get back to Illinois. I know how you guys from Wisconsin view us from the tropics. So,
Jeremy, of course, is with Don Markley and Associates, and when I first started coming to the Broadcasters Clinic, it was the Don Show. He entertained us and informed us and educated us for a long time. And I think that Jeremy has most of the same skill sets that Don had. And I don't know, Don Borchert, you might want to comment on this, but I always thought that the reason that you started to talk to Jeremy instead of Don is because Don had a million jokes, but in today's climate, they're so politically incorrect that I figure it was just too big a liability to have Don here. And Jeremy has a few stories, but you've learned that you can't get away with that crap
anymore.
That's right.
That's right. So,
anyway, here's Jeremy Ruck.
All right. Well, when Steve said he was going to introduce me this morning, I got a little bit scared about it, and he asked me if there was anything off limits, and I told him there wasn't. So, Steve, thanks for being nice to me. Thanks to the committee for inviting me back. It's a pleasure to be back here again with you guys this year. And Gordon asked me if I could shorten my presentation up a little bit, so I've got a ton of stuff to talk about today. I'm probably going to talk real fast. If we don't get to it all, hit me up after we get done, and I'll be happy to talk with you about anything that you want to talk about. Those of you that have had the misfortune of seeing me before know that I always start off with a little bit of humor. You guys were great last year in keeping the rotten produce down, so I appreciate that. As you know, I'm from the Peoria area. I've moved to Canton, Illinois, which is about 30 miles southwest of Peoria. It's kind of a redneck county. We've, in Illinois, gotten away with new laws where you have to put a carbon monoxide detector in. I think the new law that we're going to have is you have to put a fire alarm in. So this is my answer right here to the new fire alarm. And, of course, we're in the middle of the election season this year, and those of you who know me know that I tend to be very conservative, both professionally and politically. But I think Maxine's got the right idea here, that we'll just move the conservative liberals in the middle of the road so she can run them over. All right, that's all I got this morning. We're going to talk about coverage fundamentals. We're going to talk about coverage today. I apologize for the screen. I guess it didn't get sized too well. So with that, our first topic, we're going to look at the importance of coverage and interference. We're going to look at some of the mechanics of broadcast coverage. And remember, I'm going to stick primarily to broadcast AM, FM, and TV here today. There are going to be some other things that come up with translators, low powers, things like that, but we're not going to quite address that in this presentation. If you do want to talk about it, hit me up and we can discuss it. We'll factor in interference. That's obviously a big problem today. As we get more and more stations on, interference becomes much more of a concern. International incidents. Okay? We're not an isolated country here. We have several others around us. So we need to take a look at what happens on the international stage. And finally, give you a couple of examples, walking through some coverage and show you maybe some things that you perhaps haven't thought about. Okay, importance of coverage and interference. I think it goes without saying, and everybody would agree in this room, that as broadcast engineers and broadcast professionals, we live and die by the coverage of our facility. If you're not serving things adequately, obviously the revenue stream is not there. Therefore, you have a failing enterprise. Now, the United States is somewhat unique in the world stage as far as broadcasting goes. Nobody disagrees that the public airwaves and the spectrum of the United States belongs to the people, but the way it's managed in our country is slightly different or considerably different depending on which country you look at relative to others. Here we have private enterprise predominantly involved in broadcasting. Most other countries, it's the government running it. Okay? Now, in order to protect everybody, we have criteria that are imposed for protection. And keep in mind, this works two ways. This is protection for other stations, protection for your station, but more importantly also, it's protection for the people of the United States for which our airwaves, or by whom our airwaves are owned. We have to do an equal distribution, or that's the goal anyway. I think the commission strayed from that a little bit. But we want to protect the people to make sure that they have a listable signal and also make sure that you guys have a viable opportunity to provide your service. Engineers, we all know theory and practice vary. No doubt about that, okay? And this is very important right here. Rule compliance does not necessarily guarantee that you're going to have specific coverage, okay? It's kind of a best guess based on a model, but there are going to be some other things that factor in that may affect that. Similarly, rule compliance isn't going to guarantee that you don't have interference, all right? Mechanics of broadcast coverage. Okay, our coverage, as I mentioned, is defined and based on specific models. We have several of them, and we're going to take a look at them as we walk through this presentation. Now, all the services, AM, FM, and TV, look at their propagation based on various sets of curves. All right, with the AM, we're looking at ground wave and sky wave curves. We know the difference between that, ground wave for day, sky wave for night. And for FM and TV, we're looking at a different set of curves, the F curves. Okay. This is also important to note that our definition of coverage is going to vary between the services, obviously, but it also varies within the services, depending on what class you are, frequency ranges, that type of thing. Okay, here's our infamous AM ground wave curves. Everybody's seen these, right? Okay, well, we've got here basically a curve for 550. This is the extended distance version, and this is the one that's truncated to 50 kilometers. Okay, obviously, if we get beyond 50 kilometers, which is right here, then we shift over to this side of the curve and work our way down. And basically, what this tells us is, based on ground connectivity, what's an AM signal do? Okay, now what I showed you here is I kept the 50-kilometer curve that we had on the previous screen and moved up to the upper end of the band with this one. And what I wanted to demonstrate was to show you how much an effect frequency can have on your AM. Okay, look here. Our bottom curve drops off here at about 22 kilometers or so, but over here we're up around 40. All right, and you can see the distribution between the connectivities. So obviously we can intuitively see, I think we know this, that your coverage daytime on AM is going to vary depending on what frequency you're at and where you are in the band. Here's the infamous M3 map that the commission uses. This is a map that illustrates the predicted theoretical ground conductivity for the United States. This is kind of the basis that we use for looking at coverage and looking at allocations. If we get into a situation where you have measured data, that, of course, always prevails over theoretical data. I ran a couple of different coverage maps here to show you kind of what happens. If you look down here, you can see my ham radio call sign there, Wet Manure 9 Cowpies. Is a good buddy of mine coined that. This is a hypothetical station that I dropped right in the middle of Peoria, and what I did was I used a quarter wave tower, okay, and showed you with 1 kilowatt what happens as we move up in frequency. Now, our outside curve here is a 2 millivolt per meter daytime contour, and I also, by the way, I use connectivity of 8 here, all right? So this is at 550, and then at 1,000, and at 1,600. So you can see, obviously, if you're at the bottom of the band, you're in a much better position. Now, as we change our conductivity values, and what I did here was I kept it at 1,000 kilohertz and stepped up through kind of some run-of-the-mill conductivity values. I used 4, 8, and 15. So you can see as we increase the conductivity, we're obviously getting much bigger boost in our coverage. Now, keep in mind, this is kind of an idealistic view here where I assumed uniform conductivity across, you know, all distances. When you get out in the real world, obviously connectivity shifts are going to take place, so it's not going to look like a circle for the most part. So we obviously know that our coverage is going to be a function of power, and we've seen it's a function of frequency, and it's a function of ground connectivity. But the other key part that we have to look at is it's also the function of the radiated field. Okay, how well does your antenna perform? I apologize, this curve didn't quite scan in as well as I would have liked it to, but this is out of the Commission Rules 73190. You can look it up if you're interested. And what this is the theoretical efficiency for an AM radiator. And see up here, here's our magical 5/8 wave. Okay, so our efficiency on an antenna, on an AM antenna, is going to peak at 5/8 wave. As you get on the other side of the curve, the efficiency drops down, but that's because we start splitting the field into lobes. Now, what I did here was I went back to our 1,000 kilohertz station, assumed that we had our ground conductivity of 8, and then walked you through three kind of common radiator sizes that we see. The inner contour is based on a 90-degree tower, a quarter wave. Then we move out to a half wave, and then out to a 5/8 wave. And you can see that the field doesn't have quite as big of effect as some of the other constraints that we put on it we looked at a little bit ago. Okay, our protected coverage for an AM is going to be based on class, B, C, and Ds. Bs, of course, are what we used to call the old class 2s and some of the old class 3s. The Cs are the guys that are like 1490, 1400, and the Ds are daytimers. Okay, these guys are typically protected to the half millivolt ground wave conductivity during daytime hours. If you're an A, and I should have put typically on here because there are some quirky things that can happen, but these guys are protected to 0.1. All right, this is your WBBM, your WLS, these type of stations. Okay. For the B and Cs, we're going to typically protect them to an interference-free contour at night. So, Steve. No, that's bad news too. That's bad news too. Yeah. Where's Gordon at? Where's Gordon? See, I didn't have to shorten it up, did I? When Gordon called me, actually when I started talking with the committee about doing this, I gave him a couple of ideas. I said, hey, let's look at Smith charts or let's look at the coverage mechanics. And the idea was you guys might like the coverage thing a little bit better. So I started working on the presentation, figured I had about an hour, and then Gordon called me and said, hey, we want to shorten you up a little bit, and I realized I had 35 minutes. So I guess now you guys are stuck listening to me for a little bit longer anyway, but I promise I won't carry on too long. Yeah, where's the applause on that, by the way? Okay, so as I said, our Bs and Cs we're going to typically protect to an interference-free contour night. That interference-free contour value is going to fluctuate depending on the interference on that particular frequency. So station A in Madison is going to have a different interference-free contour depending on what frequency they are. Similarly, if I take the same station in Madison and move it to Peoria, Chicago, whatever, it's going to vary as well. All right. So there's no real uniform coverage at protection at nighttime for the B and C guys. Obviously, these are daytimers. They're not protected at night, so keep that in mind. One interesting quirk on the daytime rules, by the way, if you are a B or a C, you're supposed to serve your community of license at night. If you're still classified as a D, you do not have to serve your community of license at night. But since there's no free lunch, you don't get any protection. Okay, we dropped a station in to Kansas City a few years ago. On 760, as everybody knows, that's WJR's frequency. They're a clear out of Detroit, and their coverage contour gets just about to Kansas City. Well, in order to make it a Class B station to serve their city of license, our client's city of license, which is actually in Overland Park, we were looking at something like six towers, a half wavelength in height. Yeah, right. Okay, do the math. Art, you got it right there, didn't you? Six towers at 760 half wavelength, we're talking 600-foot towers. We'd probably have airplanes landing on that array. So the idea was to scrap that. We used the quirk in the rules where we don't have to cover Overland Park at night, slapped an array right on the east side of Kansas City, and we serve the entire city of Kansas City with it. Now, obviously, it's a gamble because the commission could at any time pull the plug on that. But it was an interesting solution to a problem. Okay, our Class A's, as I mentioned, and I probably should have put typically in here as well. We're looking at the half millivolt, 50% sky wave. Alaska guys have it a little bit different. There's a quirk in the rules on Alaska that if they have a higher interference level, you protect them to that level. Okay. Now, as we all know, our FM and TV is going to be a lot simpler to deal with. We don't have to look at the frequency problems. We don't have to look at the ground connectivity issues. Now, the predominant method, I think we're all familiar with this, is the FCC contour method. Okay? What we do with the, and I guess I should back up just a little bit on the FM, or the contour method. What the contour method does is it samples terrain along radials, creates an average, and says, okay, that's how far the coverage goes. Well, we can see if you intuitively think about it, that's going to fall apart in certain areas. For our DTV, we're looking really at a hybrid of the FCC model and Longley Rice. And I'll explain that a little bit and show you how that works here in a little bit. Longley Rice, I was talking with, I think it was Steve, I was talking with you. We were talking about Longley Rice earlier. Longley Rice is typically not accepted by the commission for FM use, except in a very narrowly defined set of circumstances. So if this is something you need to keep in mind, that, you know, if you run the coverage and, hey, it looks great by Longley Rice, if it doesn't meet other certain criteria, like what is the delta H, the H differential, the height differential across paths, you're not going to be able to use it. Actually, there was a case in Kansas where this was definitively defined by Ed Delahunt, who has now gone back to Minnesota, when he was one of the engineers at the commission. There was a letter that was issued that cleared this up. And I actually have this sort of like, you know, on the wall so we can always remember it. All right, our contour method, we're going to use a couple families of curves here. All right, we have the F50-50 curves, which are used for coverage. Now, what the F50-50 curves are telling us is that it's predicted 50% of the locations, 50% of the time, you're going to have a signal level equal to or greater than the value predicted. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? All right, good. Our F50-10s are the ones we're going to use for interference. Now, what we've done there is we're saying 50% of the locations, 10% of the time. All right? So, intuitively, we're thinking interference is going to be more perceptible to people than looking at the mechanics of coverage. So that's why we've gone to this 10% with the generation of the curves. Interestingly enough, the commission sometimes has a policy of arguing with consultants over where contours lie. I've gotten into battles with the commission where they've said, you have overlap that is 0.05 kilometers. Okay? If you look at the derivation of these curves, it looked like somebody fired buckshot at the side of a barn and drew a line through the middle of it. So I defy anybody to predict coverage down that close, okay, to 50 meters. Now, our contour distance is determined by average terrain elevations between 3 and 16 kilometers, as I mentioned. For those of us who aren't really metric savvy, that's 2 to 10 miles, okay? As I mentioned, this method's going to fall apart very, very easily, all right? Let's take a look at an example here. Now, what I did here, this is just a hypothetical station, and obviously this is kind of an extreme case. But what I said was our center radiation is 300 meters above mean sea level. And I said, all right, we're going to send, now obviously the sample density is going to be much greater than this, but for purposes of example, I limit it to sampling a point every kilometer. And you can see if our terrain is at 100 meters consistently all the way out, well, our average is 100. At site 2, well, it's sea level, but somebody put a wall out there in the middle somewhere at 1,400 meters. Well, that averages out to 100 meters as well. Okay? The FCC method is going to predict that we've got the exact same coverage for both of these sites. All right? I think everybody knows that our brick wall here is going to attenuate the signal very substantially. Okay? And obviously, this is a very much an extreme example of how the model flies apart. But the FCC model tends to work very well, or decently well, in moderate terrain. The curves were actually defined for the delta H I talked about, the variation in terrain across a path, of about 50 meters. Okay, so when we start getting too far either side of that, then we start seeing that the model falls apart. Mountainous terrain, okay? Everybody can see that. Mountain ranges are going to distort things considerably. You're going to have shadowing, or you're going to have signal impediments. So the FCC model does not deal with these issues very well. Similarly, if we've got excessively smooth terrain, we're out in North Carolina or Florida where it's basically a beach, okay? We're going to have some real problems with the coverage there. It doesn't deal with excessively smooth terrain or terrain that slopes down gently. Commission recognizes this. This is why they let you get away with Longley Rice in certain cases, as I mentioned. Now, these cases are typically going to be limited to city license coverage or main studio rule issues. All right, you're not going to get to use it for interference. Longley Rice, we know, is terrain dependent. We're going to consider the terrain along the entire path as well as the signal path, so we get an accurate prediction of what's really going on. So we see this is obviously going to have a much better approximation to what our signal is really doing in the real world. And I think this goes without saying, you know, we've all got computers that have lots and lots of horsepower. I think, what was it, they send the shuttle astronauts up with a computer that has the power to play Frogger, I think was the old joke. Anybody remember Frogger? Yeah, okay, all you 80s guys like me. Everybody's got a real good desktop now, okay? So we got a lot of computing power. Longley Rice stuff used to have to run on a mainframe. Even then, it was hard to see it because you weren't getting a good graphical output. So the prevalence of this has become a lot more easy to see in recent years. Okay, so I mentioned we're going to limit that pretty much to city license coverage and main studio issues. Okay, I did put the not in there. Sorry. The commission is not going to allow you to use Longley Rice for interference considerations. Okay, they're still going to stick to the old traditional contour model. Even if they know there's a terrain obstruction out there, you're not going to be able to get away with Longley Rice on the FM broadcast. All right, there are ways you can use that in the low-power TV and translators, things like that. But FM, they're going to make you stick to the arcane contour model. I think part of it is their argument they don't have the resources to deal with the extra computations. I think there's also some fear that because Longley Rice can be so site-dependent, that if you lock somebody in on a particular site and they have to move, it's going to totally skew things. So I think there's kind of a double-pronged approach as to why they do that. As I mentioned, we're going to be able to use Longley Rice for interference on low-power guys, Class A, and DTV. Okay. And as I mentioned a little bit ago, our Longley Rice model, and those of you guys that are TV guys know that it's intimately involved with our DTV coverage and interference predictions. Okay. Okay, our protected coverage area of an FM station, we're going to define that by the use of the F50-50 curves in the FCC method. Okay. Class A's, C's, C0's, C1's, 2's, and 3's are all protected in the 60 dBu or 1 millivolt per meter contour. Okay. If you're a B1, and I should point out this is B1 commercial, okay? B1 non-com guys, they're still protected to 60. But the B1 guys get a break, 57 dBu, or to 0.7 millivolt. Bs, they get an even better break at 3 more dB. But the non-com guys are still all protected to 60. Okay, the commission basically says that interference is not going to be permitted within these protected service contours. This doesn't apply to grandfathered situations, all right? We all know that there are problems out there with spacings. The commission's changed the rules. But new stuff that you put on, you're not going to be able to create interference within somebody else's predicted contour by the commission's method. Doesn't mean that you're not going to have interference. I'm going to show you an example here in a little bit of a station where there is no contour overlap, and in fact there's quite a bit of contour separation, and they still have predicted interference. Okay. Sneaky government, all right? They always leave themselves an out. Okay. 73209, basically what the commission says is, hey, look, if you're authorized by this section of the rules, you got no guarantee that you're not going to have interference, okay? So they were kind of smart, kind of sneaky in the same way, and realized that their stuff has some problems, but it's kind of the best approximation we can do. All right, for our NTSC stations, we're going to look at the protected service areas being a grade B contour. And for VHF low, we're looking at 47. VHF high is 56, and UHF is 64. And of course, this is the last time I get to talk about those numbers here with you guys. Everybody happy about that, by the way? That we're getting rid of analog and going to make life easier? I hope. Okay. Of course, VHF low is 2 through 6, high 7 to 13, and UHF is 14 to 69, which of course is now 14 to 51. Okay. For a protected coverage for DTV, we're going to use both the FCC contour method and Longley Rice. Our protected coverage for DTV, we're going to call the service area. Okay, and this is kind of a long sentence here. All right, basically what we're looking at is we're looking at the area within the noise-limited contour that receives an interference-free signal equal to or greater than the noise-limited value. Okay? Picture's worth a thousand words, so I'll show you how this works out here in just a couple of minutes. Okay. DTV guys expect interference within your noise-limited contour. I think the commissions realize that we're not going to be able to get away with that. Also, the transition, everybody running two channels, you got to expect some interference. They've also tacitly sort of gone along with it as well. We got the 0.5 interference standard, all right? So everybody knows you're going to have a little bit of interference. Some guys got off real easy with Appendix B with no interference. Some stations have as much as 10, 11, 12%, okay? This is one thing I think a lot of people may not necessarily think about, but you need to expect that you are going to have areas outside the noise-limited contour where you're going to have a usable signal, okay? Just because we have an arbitrary, mathematically defined contour does not mean that the real-world propagation is going to stop at that wall, okay? The contour, the area within the contour, is to what you're protected, but it's not equal to the practical limit of your coverage, okay? So just because you get a nice, pretty map from your consulting engineer that says, hey, here's your DTV service area, don't forget you got stuff outside. You may want to ask them, what's it really look like outside? Because that way then you can serve those people, those viewers, that you may be trying to write off based on the commission's model. And of course, you've got to keep in mind that the actual coverage is going to be greater or less. If you get the mountainous obstructions that we talked about, remember, our contour falls apart. So the contour may be more distant than what the actual signal predicts, okay? Similarly, if you get in the smooth terrain, you're going to have, you know, a greater distance for the longer rise. For the UHF guys, we do a little bit of compensation for the antennas being used. It's the dipole adjustment factor. It's a function of frequency. So the noise-limited value for UHFs is going to shift around a little bit. For the lows, we use 28 dBU. F5090. Now notice we've gone to 90 here now, so we're talking about 90% of the time. Digital, we think about that, that's obviously much more important because we got the cliff effect, okay? 36 dBU for the VHF highs, and the UHF kind of centers around 41. That's going to go up and down just a little bit depending on how the dipole adjustment factor is used. And although we're using our F5090 for coverage, we're still looking at the F5010 for determining interference from other facilities to your facility. All right, let's factor in some interference here now. For FM stations, our primary method of avoiding interference is through geographic spacings. Okay? And the reason I say primary here is I think everybody agrees that the vast majority of stations are, if you look at the numbers, although this filing window may change some of that, but most of the stations out there are going to be commercial guys. They're going to be in the upper part of the band. And predominantly, we're going to look at spacings under 73207 or maybe some of the predecessors, depending on how old your station is. Okay? The spacing tables, if you look at them, they are based on the assumption, on contour distance, assuming uniform terrain all the way around. If you calculate the numbers out, you'll find that the appropriate distances are there with just a little bit of slop in between them. Interestingly enough, there used to be an anomaly in the spacing tables. If you were west of the Mississippi in the Class C area, those of you who have been broadcasting a while remember that probably that the old second adjacent was a 20 dB ratio instead of the 40 dB ratio that it is now. Well, the commission had screwed up the calculations on the spacing tables, and what happened was there was absolutely no way you could make a contour protection thing work if you were slightly short space, if you were second adjacent. Well, they didn't want to change the spacing tables because what happens then is now a whole bunch of people are short spaced. So the easy fix was let's just change the protection ratio, and it worked out real well because we got digital tuners now which are less susceptible to the second adjacent problem. Obviously, regular terrain is going to skew the contour distances, okay? If you've got, and that can truncate or extend the actual interference. All right, keep that in mind. It's a two-way street. It's possible to meet spacings and yet fail your contour overlap requirements. Okay? If we're looking at certain samples of the way that the terrain works, this kind of a condition can, in fact, happen. All right? Guys that are in this type of a situation where you're meeting the spacings, but if you look at the actual contours and there's overlap, you're going to be the ones that are probably going to be more likely to experience interference on the fringes of your coverage area. Okay? So if you've got a situation like that, you may want to take a look and see if there's actually something there. As I mentioned, if the spacings are not met, you do have an alternative of using contour protection. Okay? That's where we get under the 215 authorizations. Keep in mind, though, if you employ contour protection, you forfeit your right to full interference protection. Anybody gotten a request from some of these consultants that are trying to move 12 or 15 stations around to get somebody to move into somewhere? Anybody get those? Anybody look on there where they ask you to accept a 73215 authorization? Okay, be very, very careful of those. Very, very careful. What happens is if you're authorized under 207 by the geographic spacings, you're protected to a full facility of that class regardless at which parameters you're operating. Okay? So if you're a C1, for instance, you're operating with 100 kW at maybe 130 meters above average terrain, you're protected as if you were at 100 kW at 299 meters. Okay? In terms of contour protection and the spacings. If you go along with the 215, you then become protected to what you actually have, all right? Which will then, obviously, now you're in a short space situation, you may have trouble moving, and you're going to forfeit any right that you may have had to ever upgrade that facility down the road, all right? So be very, very careful if you get some of those to make sure that it fits in with any future plans that you may have. Now, going along with the 215 thing could be kind of beneficial, all right? There's no free lunch, remember that. If perhaps you're going to get an increase in population served, okay? We're going to do this, move a little bit closer to a city, and we may pick up 500,000 people. Well, you know, that's probably a worthwhile endeavor to do, okay? Might make the value of the property much better, cash flow, things like that. So once again, when you get stuff like this, talk with your consultant about it. They'll give you some ideas, and obviously you're going to need to speak with the owners and figure out what the business plan is as well. Contour protection, though, still has to meet some absolute minimum spacing requirements. All right? There are still some absolute minimums. Now, these absolute minimums that are under this basically fall out of the definition of a directional antenna. All right? If you build a directional antenna, the front to back, the maximum to min ratio on it, is not allowed to exceed 15 dB. Okay? Also, similarly, your rate of change cannot exceed 2 dB across 10 degrees of azimuth. All right. Now, non-com guys get a little bit of a break on this. You can actually have a greater slope than that as long as that arc over where you're making that slope is not an area where you're protecting another station. Okay. So if you, as I talked about earlier, where we look at the uniform terrain and calculate the contour distances to come out with the spacings, if you do this 15 dB front to back, you'll find that the absolute minimums drop out, okay? Directional antennas, of course, permissible for AM, FM, and TV. Typically, they're going to be used for FM, for interference protection. Same thing for TV, although with TV and AM, we also are looking more as a coverage thing as well, okay? Doesn't make any sense to blow a bunch of energy over Lake Michigan if you can afford it. All right, if you can afford a directional antenna. Similarly, you know, New Orleans, WWL, prime example, doesn't make any sense for them to blow a bunch of energy off into the Gulf of Mexico. So they use a directional antenna to blow it north. Okay. Now, we could do it on certain coverage goals also, as I just mentioned. The FM guys, be careful on this too as well, because when you go to a directional antenna, you've now established an envelope, okay? If you stay non-directional, and I got to be real careful talking about this. Steve, you know where I'm going, I think. Don't you? You hear guys talk about optimizing your antenna, okay? If you keep the standard mounting brackets and don't monkey around with it, it's acceptable. It's okay to figure out what is the best way to orient or to mount it on the tower, okay? Just don't change any of the components, all right? So this is where this can sometimes be a problem. You're a rim shot trying to serve a town. Well, let's swing the antenna around and get the boost off the tower in that direction, okay? With a directional antenna, you lose that, all right? Your 6 kW ERP or your 25, that's what it is, okay? All right, our contour protection, obviously we can also achieve that through a reduction in ERP. You can also achieve it in a reduction in height. Problem with this, of course, you're going to lose coverage, all right? But it is an option. If you're right at a particular threshold, you may want to do a little bit of a decrease in height to get away from a directional antenna, then we can use the tower distortion, that type of game that you can play. Okay. All right, international incidents. This is actually kind of a detailed thing, and I did shorten this one up quite a bit based on the original assumption of the time I had. North America is pretty fortunate to have cooperation in international matters. All right, all the countries have kind of agreed, let's cooperate, let's figure out how we can help each other out. Europe, they don't quite have this. Anybody know what the answer to interference is in Europe? What's that? We'll let it happen, but if one guy's interfering with you, how do you fix that guy? Crank up the power, exactly. All right, exactly. So as everybody keeps cranking the power up, well, nobody's ultimately is going to be usable. All right, guys in North America, we got a little bit smarter when we left the old world. We figured out how to cooperate with each other, and so we've got agreements with the United, with Canada, with Mexico, the Bahamas, to take care of these type of international issues, and also to address mutual cooperation. All right. What we don't want to have happen is you don't want the United States to all of a sudden suck up all the allotments along either border. So by working together, we can make sure that, you know, countries are protected and get to serve their people with their airwaves as well. Typically, interference protection is not going to be afforded to a station in another country. All right, so if you're an American station, you got nighttime coverage in Canada, well, you're really going to be protected at the border. All right, you aren't going to be protected in Canada. Conversely, the Canadian guys, what's that? Is he here? Oh, crap. All right. All right, well, actually, we're into examples, so we're good. We're getting close. All right, I'm going to pick on WCBU real quick. What I drew you here was to show you the 70 and the 60 service contours. Now, here's Longley Rice and the same thing. I'm sorry the green didn't come out. I should have changed the color on that. But you can see here where Longley Rice is actually helping our coverage, and it's actually larger than what the contours indicate. Similarly, we got some areas along these river bottoms where the signal's less, okay? Now, here's the allocation study for this particular facility. Note that we got no contour overlap with anybody else that's prohibited. When we look at it in terms of Longley Rice and interference, these colored areas here are areas where there's predicted interference. If you look right here, look at that. That was the KAYP that had, you know, the contour was back over here, but look, we actually have interference inside, okay? Picked on WQAD down at the Quad Cities to show you some DTV stuff here. This is what I was talking about with the DTV service area. This is an illustration of WQAD service area. You see the blue is where it exceeds the, and they're on channel 38, I think it is. So this is where it exceeds 41 dBU. We got the noise limited contour, and then here's the interference areas. Okay. So I started out, here's the contour. All right, and there's a scale change on the maps in here, so I apologize for that, but watch for it. Now look at the Longley Rice, okay? Yeah, see, he's got quite a bit of coverage outside the contour. Now here's where the scale change happens, because what I did was I gave an extra 6 dB figuring on people with outside directional antennas. All right? Now we factor the interference into it. Well, see, he's got interference out here, but look at these areas. There's a bunch of areas outside the contour where you're still at the signal level. So this is going to be a usable area, okay? So just because here's where the contour is doesn't mean his coverage stops there, okay? We did get it pretty close, didn't we? All right, well, thanks, everybody. Any questions?
What have you experienced with the cliff edge effect in DTV, you know, because you have contours, you know, it's great. You're going to be able to define the digital contour and digital television very close. Have you experienced any of this where, you know, that half dB cliff edge effect, you know, within a quarter of a mile or so, one person will get the signal, the next one won't? Have you had any experience with this?
Yeah, and the problem we've got there is we've got a lot of variables to look at. You got construction, antenna type, receiver sensitivity, things like that. So definitively nailing it down, yes, it is. It can be a very, very short area. I mean, obviously, it's a cliff. So it can be a very, very small area in which this effect takes over. But there are a lot of variables that factor in to why it happens, you know, to the Joneses and not to the Smiths across the street. So that's part of the issue is trying to nail down exactly what's going on. I do have a client, and that's actually the NBC affiliate in Las Vegas, and one of the things they're concerned about, they've got channel 3 for analog and channel 2 for digital. Well, Vegas doesn't have a lot of impulse noise problems because it's a new city, all the power lines are buried. But what they are finding is they're having some problems with reception in buildings because of the thermal considerations with the desert that a lot of these buildings have a metallic structure. Okay? So, and if you think about, you know, you listen to an AM radio going underneath an overpass, you know, you got the basically the, it's basically a big waveguide cutting off. You've got the same type of effect going on that windows and doorways are not large enough to get the signal through at VHF, but they work fine at UHF. So I don't think we, and I think some of the guys that have 7 through 13, I think some of the scuttlebutt now is that people are not sure those channels are working quite as well as everybody thought as well. So there are a lot of factors that do figure into that. Anybody else? Okay, I either put you to sleep or I explained everything real well. So thank you very much, everybody. I appreciate it, and I'll be hanging around for a while, so if anybody, you know, wants to ask any questions.